Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today's guest is Kelly Swanson. And Kelly is professor in human nutrition at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Kelly, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you give us a sense of your background? Are you a nutritionist by training, or what is your background and how did you come to take an interest in this field in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, I'm trained as a nutritionist. And since I was knee high, I was a pre-vet major for a long time, thought I'd go into veterinary medicine. Somewhere along the line in an undergraduate training, I got interested in nutrition and kind of took me that way. Then during my nutrition training, really during my PhD work with George Fahey, my focus was dietary effects on gut health, but a lot of those effects were testing, not just fibers, but prebiotics and probiotics were also included. And so that included humans at that time and dogs. Since then, I did a postdoc in functional genomics, but then I kind of came back around where I started. I have my research really is in a few different areas, but the gut health area, especially testing a lot of the biotics, is one that I've been working on for quite a while.
And do you consider biotics, like prebiotics, probiotics, postbiotics, synbiotics, to be nutrients?
Yeah, they're in a very interesting area, I believe. And even fiber is, in kind of that area where it's very difficult to show a deficiency necessarily like a traditional nutrient. But I do think we can show definitely health benefits of their consumption. So I think they're kind of in this gray area. But again, the live dietary microbes, there's a effort going on there to kind of think about that as a consumption and should we be recommending, consumption there. So certainly the prebiotics easily, I think, fit into kind of where the fiber category is, but the others are a little bit more unique. But I do think, again, I'm a believer, so I think all these are beneficial to health. And even if it's very difficult to show a deficiency, I think they are, essential in our diets.
And when you started coming across these biotics, what was the most compelling story, if you like, that really started you down that journey of becoming a believer?
Yeah, I think, it's interesting from a nutritionist perspective, you think about the essential nutrients and what you're feeding the host. And that's where I think where all this excitement around the microbiome and everything took off as well, that we're not only feeding the host, we're feeding all the microorganisms that are there that are maybe using what the host doesn't use. And then there's this, again, symbiosis there of the bacteria and other microorganisms there that they're benefiting, but then the host benefits even more by their activity. And so that's what really got me interested in not only nutrition, the impacts that the nutrients can have on, the host health, but then, okay, now we're feeding this microorganism population as well. And so it's, to some extent, it's a black box. We don't know really what's going on in there in the gut sometimes, but it's pretty amazing. And that's what really got me interested in the area.
Yeah, I'm interested, Kelly, in what you think about the efforts to try to establish health benefits. You have lots of highly cited papers, but you have a very interesting one about shifts where you feed fiber, soluble corn fiber and polydextrose, and you get notable shifts in the fecal microbiota. And what does that mean in terms of health? Like, do you feel like it's enough to show that there's this intermediate step, that there's an improvement in feeding fiber in an outcome that may be associated with health? Or do you have to go all the way and show the actual tangible health benefit that would be meaningful to the human?
In 2016, FDA kind of came out with their definition of what fiber was at that time. And I think there still are a lot of definitions of what fiber is. But when FDA came out and said, this is fiber, that impacted a lot of food products at that time, here in the United States anyway. And so people had to petition and kind of demonstrate maybe that what is, maybe was it not a, maybe thought of as a traditional fiber, and polydextrose is one of those that fit, probably the soluble corn fiber as well, doesn't maybe fit the traditional definition of, you know, something that's intact and intrinsic to this plant material. There had to, you know, you have to kind of show if they're isolated or a synthetic substance, they have to show health benefits. And so when they defined what fiber was, those health benefits became very, very important from a regulatory perspective. And at that time, and it's still currently, the modulating the microbiota and modulating their the metabolites they produce is not by itself a health benefit. It's, I think we all believe that's certainly a mechanism by which they function, but it's not itself a health benefit. So FDA still goes off of, you know, whether it's laxation, whether if it's, you know, weight management, lowering blood lipids, you know, think there's about six or seven different health benefits if you say they demonstrate. And so it's a, you know, interesting area, but that's what we struggle with in human studies. And I would say a lot of, you know, our work, we focus on dogs and cats, not as a model, but for the sake of dogs and cats and pet foods and veterinary medicine, we struggle with, can we obtain the samples we need? Can we do the testing that, you know, trying to be non-invasive, that is physiologically relevant? Because you can take a fecal sample and measure metabolites, you can measure microbes, but I always struggle with that, that, you know, can we measure something that is maybe that says, yes, this is a health benefit versus it's just a shift that it's difficult to tie to health.
And it always strikes me, Kenny, that if the microbiome, and I regard it, it's not my wording, but as a virtual organ, yet another organ that we have in our bodies, one that we acquire rather than one that we're born with, but that it's an organ and plays a role in our health, and therefore changing it could very well impact health. But wouldn't you expect then that antibiotics, something that dramatically changes the microbiome and potentially not for the better, would have severe side effects and severe consequences? Why not? If the microbiome is so important, how can we, in inverted commas, damage it with antibiotics and yet not really experience too many side effects as a result of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure I have a great answer for you, but that's the thing. You know, oftentimes maybe it's the short-term effect that in the short term, maybe there can be some, you know, some of the bacteria, they probably don't go down to zero, but they kind of get into survival mode, I think. And you see that with some diseases and in some, you know, low residue diets where there's maybe not much food around and or the environment has changed and they kind of, you know, just, again, I guess I think of it as survival mode. I'm not going to do too much, but I'm going to be here. And when the environment changes, then I'll kind of come back to the normals or the activity that's typically there. But it is difficult, yeah, when you have studies like that. I mean, clearly germ-free versus, notobiotic animals versus conventional, you can see the great differences. But you're right that we're pretty adaptable and the microbiota are pretty adptable. That if you get, you know, food poisoning or you run into something that you shouldn't, you definitely have a short-term effect. But long-term, we are able to typically be able to recover. And that's, I think, what makes this difficult. And even from I would say, I'm a nutritionist, so oftentimes what I'm testing is a diet effect. And we can show great changes from a diet effect, just huge, I would say, reference range of what's normal. And you don't see a physiological effect. The animal or the human looking you in the eyes is still healthy, but their microbiome has completely shifted. So that's where part of that might be, you know, our focus on taxonomy maybe all the time, that we get so fixated on that. Instead of looking at functional, you know, there's so much overlap there that maybe we should be looking at different things. But no, that's a great question of, because it's so, you know, I think we believe it's essential, but again, like you say, you hit it with a strong antibiotic and see this huge shift. But then oftentimes we've done this in dogs and cats recently, and you don't even see diarrhea sometimes. You can see a big shift in the microbiota, but again, they're eating fine and they, relatively speaking, they look okay. And so it is difficult to kind of determine that. And I wonder, you know, is it a long-term, you know, would there be other changes there? But yeah, from a diet perspective, we've fed everything from raw meat diets all the way to kibble foods or even recently a vegan food. So that, you know, the dog is an omnivore, so you have to watch nutrition, but the microbiome is greatly shifting and they're healthy, you know, from eating one diet or the other, as long as they're nutritionally balanced. And so that's what's been, I guess, exciting for me, but also frustrating on the microbiome side, that you see these big changes. And from a health perspective, someone could argue, well, that's just as healthy today as it was yesterday. And the microbiome's, you know, shifted greatly. And I think that's where we still need to, as a research community, still, you know, do more research and understand, are we looking at the right thing? Or maybe we're not collecting the correct samples. You know, are there other things that maybe at the mucosal level, maybe things are changing or they're not changing when in the fecal samples they are.
You've also done a lot of stuff with symbiotics. First, just tell us what, remind everybody what they are, and then answer the hypothetical questions. If you feed somebody a symbiotic and you get a health outcome that you observe, and you also see the prebiotic results in some shift in the composition of the microbes, what do you make of that evidence?
We really went around on this quite a bit. You know, what is the definition? And then how do you show, what are the criteria you need to meet to say, yes, this is a symbiotic or no, it's not? And, you know, we built really the symbiotic. The definition was based on what we had with probiotics and prebiotics before that. And so, you know, the probiotics being the live microorganism, you know, providing a health benefit, the prebiotic, you know, being a substrate basically for the commensal bacteria that hopefully selectively, you know, I guess we say selectively utilized by the host microbes, again, and then having that health benefit. So when we came about the symbiotic, we did initially, we thought, is this just a probiotic plus a prebiotic? Many of the examples, and I think of the products out there, are that very thing. But we thought that might restrict certain areas from an innovative perspective. Also, there might be some substrates and maybe some microorganisms where they need a combination to provide a health benefit. So really, when we came down to it, it's a mixture of, you know, live microorganisms and substrates that are utilized by the host that provide a health benefit is really what the symbiotic is.
If I take a organism that I know is a probiotic and I combine it with some sort of substrate, some candidate prebiotic, and I recapitulate the same health benefit when I give people that combination, and if I include it in the study, an arm where they just got the candidate prebiotic but did not get the probiotic, and the people in that arm didn't see a benefit, but they did see maybe a potential shift in the amount of the good bacteria in their gut, would you say, well, that's not really a symbiotic because they're just proving that what we already knew is a probiotic is a probiotic?
Yeah, that's where we really got down to that of what can you prove. And from the prebiotic perspective, it is very difficult to show that selectivity, number one, and also functioning through the microbes that you're feeding something, and whether it's in vitro, potentially, that's often where you show that, can this microbe utilize this substance? But then you go to in vivo and you're, I guess, assuming that's translating over. But again, we also talked about basically the complementary symbiotic and a synergistic. And that's where I think you're getting at as well, that each substrate and the microorganism might provide a benefit. And we discussed a lot, does there need to be synergism? I mean, hopefully there would be, but from, I guess, what we're calling a complementary symbiotic, is that each could really function on their own and provide health benefits. They don't need to work together necessarily. Ideally, they would work together. But in the end, we definitely, we gave a lot of thought around experimental design and moving forward, how would you test these? Ideally, you would have a placebo group. You'd have a group with the substrate, a group with the probiotic or the microorganism, and then this combination, you could kind of test all of them. Ultimately, if people just want to look at, you know, these two together, versus a placebo, we thought, well, that, and they show a health benefit, yes, that should function as a symbiotic, but ideally you try to tease these things out to see where the response is coming. The other thing, I guess one thing that comes into play here too is dosage. So oftentimes when you see the symbiotics, sometimes that, especially the prebiotic portion, that dosage is lower. And so you definitely want to make sure that, one, there's not antagonism here now that you've added one versus the other and there's not antagonism, but also, if the dosage is different than on its own, does it still function that way?
Would you agree? And I haven't read the consensus in quite a while now, so maybe it's already answered in there, but the two together has to kind of amplify the health benefit of either alone, at least, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the goal. And I think when we had a consensus paper, but I'm not sure there was, you know, we maybe didn't have a consensus completely when it comes to that of, you know, ideally there is this synergism, you know, between the two, but that was kind of, again, this category of synergistic, a symbiotic versus the complementary. And again, I think that is the goal. If you can turn 1 + 1 = 3, well, then that's great. You know, that again, if they're, I guess the one thing that we definitely came out and said, you can't just put, you know, an established prebiotic plus an established probiotic and put them together and assume there's not going to be, it's just going to function correctly. You still should go through the testing and do that just so there's not either some antagonism or there's some effect that you're not maybe anticipating. And so we definitely wanted that to be part of that suggestion when you're testing these substances going forward. Again, a lot of, I don't want to say any products, you know, or anything like that, but I think a lot of the existing products are, you know, existing prebiotic, existing probiotic, and now there's a combination. And but it wouldn't have to be, you know.
I just want to clarify that in a symbiotic, the prebiotic does not necessarily have to be metabolized or consumed by the microbe that is the other half, if you wish, will, of the symbiotic.
Correct. And that's where, on the complementary side, it's really, it might be the host, the commensal microbes that are already in the host gut that actually are utilizing it, and that's providing a health benefit. The probiotic also is then providing its own benefit, and without kind of the need of the substance that's added. But that's where that in the synergistic category is, that while the host microbes might be utilizing it, that microorganism is definitely, that substance is being used to providing that microorganism with a benefit and you know, stimulating its activity or supporting it selectively more than maybe what the host microbes would. And so that's kind of that distinction there of between the complementary and synergistic.
Ellie, you have done a lot of work with humans and in animals. Like, in other words, what are your thoughts about extrapolating to different species?
Yeah, I think at some level, we do this all the time in dogs and cats. Dogs and cats used to be used as models for humans, and now we often use human data to extrapolate. We can't be invasive in dogs and cats either, and so we're looking at rodent data, we're looking at human data, so oftentimes swine. So there's a lot of good pig models that the pig, the dog, and the human, there's a lot of those data, I think, that do translate fairly well. I guess I'd also ultimately say, you know, you really have to be in the target host at the end. But I do think whether you're testing mechanisms, when you're testing, again, selectivity of microorganisms, certainly in vitro assays certainly come into play there. I always just have a kind of a rule. Yeah, you have to be in the target host. But we get that question a lot in the dog and cat space that, well, we've done the testing in the dog. Can we just use the same dosage or the same substrate or even the same probiotic in the cat? And dogs and cats are similar, but they are distinct as well. And, you know, especially the cat is a strict carnivore. They're not nearly as flexible. If you have a lot of fermentation going on, they'll have negative responses to stool quality and more sometimes drastic changes on the microbiota than you would with a dog or anything else. So I do think there's some level of, there's a comparative nature there. I think it can be useful, but ultimately I do think you have to be in the target host. And that's kind of, you know, definitely what we said on the, at least I served on the prebiotic and the symbiotic consensus panels, that you need to be in that target host just because there are physiological differences and potentially, you know, dietary differences that might, you know, make that more or less important. But I do think it's important to do that at least at a final level. You can use some screening maybe up front to lay the foundation, but I think those final studies should be in the target host.
And do you find it easier to work with animals or humans? I mean, humans, and obviously there's ethical things that might come into play here, but humans are also more suggestible, I guess. A human knows they're on a trial, even if they're getting the placebo. A dog or a cat presumably does not know they're on a trial. So does that make the distinction much more easy to see, or have you considered that at all?
No, we do think about those things. You know, I don't think they're, again, kind of that placebo effect that you might see in a human study, I don't think it's not as great. We almost always have a placebo or some kind of control diet or intervention, just because if you're giving a pill or something, there still might be this response that's occurring due to that action if it's increased level of stress or something like that. But, you know, in many cases, it's easier. I would say in dog and cat, it's almost the same in many ways, just given our restrictions from the invasive side. I'd say in the livestock area, swine and poultry or aquaculture, you know, it's just the environment is not as clean oftentimes, and they're just in commercial production. There's more of a stress, whether it's, you know, how the animals are raised or just, you know, other factors, maybe environmental stressors that are there, that I think oftentimes versus I think of dog and cat. I work with a lot of animal scientists, that there are things you can do that aren't maybe scrutinized as heavily in some of the livestock species and show a stronger effect on growth performance and disease, morbidity, mortality data that we often don't have in dogs and cats. But again, with dog and cat, you have a lot more control over what they are consuming, and versus humans, you can try to get them to consume the product and not consume other things that are kind of on the exclusion list. But, you know, there's some variation there. We know that there's some variability there. So I think there are some benefits from the animal side, but it's still in the dog and cat space, it's difficult with, can we get the samples we really want to get? And can you, oftentimes, if you can get a tissue sample or something, that's really much more useful than just a fecal sample or a blood sample. And so that's where we struggle.
Ellie, I know you trained in the Midwest, and that's where I'm from. Can you talk a little bit about your background? I know you're at Illinois now. You did your undergrad at North Dakota State. When you were doing your undergrad, you were thinking about pre-vet. Did you grow up on farms, or how did you grow up, and what were you envisioning? What kind of animals were you envisioning working with?
Yeah, in another life, I'd be a large animal vet, probably in northern Minnesota, still stepping in a couple feet of snow this time. They've had a long winter up there. So that's the other side. I was pre-vet. I grew up on a beef farm. We did have sheep at some point, but I had exposure to a lot of animals. I was in 4-H, so I showed cattle and sheep, and I was on judging teams. So, I had just exposure to any typical farm animal, I would say, at least from a mammalian side. We didn't have any chickens or poultry, but we always had dogs and cats, but we had a lot of these animals. So I had a lot of animal experience before I even got to undergraduate, my undergraduate training. And then as an undergraduate, still, there's courses or other clubs and things, you get exposure to animals even more. And then that's really how I came down to Illinois, is that they were looking for someone that had animal experience, but also was interested in kind of in the comparative or human side of things. And that's really where I guess I submitted my application and had that in my personal statement, I think, or my history. You can see I worked with animals, and that's how I kind of was recruited down to Illinois. But yeah, I'll say I'm still, most of our studies, we're working in healthy humans, healthy dogs and cats, and really are looking at structure function claims where you can't really speak about a disease or you get thrown into the drug category. But I still have a lot of colleagues, and a lot of my activities, I'm interested in the clinical side of things, whether it's human medicine, but usually it's more focused on the veterinary medicine field. And so I'm really interested in that. And the microbiome and probiotics, prebiotics, all the other biotics are very, kind of a hot topic in the veterinary medicine and medical field too. So I have a lot of interest in that area. Still, even though I didn't end up going to vet school, I focused on nutrition. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things, and not everything that we do translates to the clinical side. But I think some of ours does. And then working with other colleagues, we see the true picture from different angles, of what we're trying to do on the biotic side. But yeah, that's definitely still an area of interest for me.
Have you had a chance to do much work with antibiotic resist efforts to try to curb the concerns we have with antibiotic resistance, especially with how animals are raised and the implications that has for humans?
I haven't done much in that area. We have had conducted some studies recently looking at, like in a dog and a cat, how do you show a benefit? And so we have conducted a few studies and where we have given dogs and cats antibiotics to kind of look at resistance and resilience of the microbiota, as well as, stool quality, fecal metabolites, things like that. So we have looked at that in a couple recent studies, just looking again at either a diet or a specific pre or postbiota. Can it resist or does it help, recover from that? The antibiotic dosage, but we have not looked at least in our research, have looked at any resistance, drug resistance genes or anything like that. It is certainly a much greater issue, I think, more on the livestock side, where these subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics have been taken out of feeds. In Europe, it happened decades ago, but we're a little bit slower to get to it here in the U.S. But it's even probably been a decade now, where whether it was voluntary or from a regulatory perspective, these subtherapeutic dosages were taken out of feeds, and so people have been very active and looking for alternatives then. And that's where a lot of the biotics or other means kind of come into play, that how can we still increase, hopefully increase productivity, efficiency without having the antibiotics there.
So you've witnessed this kind of interesting evolution of nutritional science into the microbiome and into this virtual organ and its role in health. Can you kind of finish up with this question? Can you predict the next big leap in nutritional science, do you think, or have you given that much thought?
Yeah, well, I would say what's happening here on campus and, federal agencies, I know, personalized nutrition, people have been talking about it all the time, but that's really something that has been moving forward. And when, as well as AI, and AI comes into, these huge data sets trying to predict whether it's the microbiome or the transcriptome or, metabolomics, trying to see, can we learn more about the physiology, more about the host, more about the microorganisms by analyzing these large data sets and maybe handling them in a little different way? So AI is certainly there as in that area, but I think a lot of things have changed over the past decade or so, but certainly adding the microbiome almost as a piece to the personalized nutrition, really personalized nutrition, personalized medicine, that I do think, you know, when you're thinking about conducting studies, should all studies, a question that comes up is, should we now take a baseline microbiome sample or fecal sample and a lot based on that? Or do you, you know, is it an inclusion exclusion criteria? There's a lot of questions that come up, but I think we know that certainly the microbiota of, like you said, it's almost like another organ system, and that should be included. And so I think that the personalized nutrition area is probably where people are going, and all the aspects of not only nutrition, but physiology and the microbiology that all kind of feed into that are all really being heavily studied now. And there's probably other things that are going to pop up as well, but that's one that certainly I think that's coming from a nutrition perspective. But all these biotics and, you know, fermented foods and all these other kind of parts of the equation are being added to it as well. So I think that's an area that's going to be going on a long time, and you know, the microbiome is a big piece of that, and the biotics are of course a big piece of that as well.
And I think of personalized nutrition, I always think when I was a child, at least, that was not a good thing. You were just called a picky eater, and that was never a good thing, because you know the food preparer never wanted to prepare four different meals for the four kids because they all had their own choices. But maybe that is the future for nutrition, do you think?
Yeah, it might not ever get down to the individual person, but there might be, you know, I know we think about, again, getting back to dogs and cats, certainly in the dog area, if you think about the great diversity genetically, but morphologically, behaviorally, there's definitely families and groups of dogs that are quite different than others. And so that's where we haven't really done much on the personalized side of that, but I do think that's another area that I haven't just been successful getting funding in that area, but I do think that's an area that we should be looking at. But at some point, you know, you can get made to order meals, you know, for in the pet space. And I'm sure, you know, from a human perspective as well, you can kind of get to that point if you want to. It might, maybe doesn't have to be to that level, but at least if it's not just, you know, here are these recommendations for the entire population. And we already have, you know, geriatric and adults and growing, you know, girls and boys, but it might be, I think it's getting to another level there that again is going to be more specific and hopefully more accurate. So then again, length of life, quality of life, you know, health aspects are the benefit or the outcome of that. So
that makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Kelly. And thank you for sharing your time with us and your experience with us. It's been really interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly.
Yeah, thank you very much.